Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom. How are you today?
Hey, Russ. I'm doing good. I'm currently suffering with good old Central Texas allergies, but other than that,
if I sound... You're sick. Don't try to tease us.
I do not have the plague currently.
Well, I don't know if I believe you, but that's okay. You're a long way away, so it's okay if you're sick. And today we're joined by Federico Lucifredi.
Lucifredi.
All right. And today we're going to talk a little bit about hardware hacking. So tell us about the work you've been doing in the area of hardware hacking. I mean, this is interesting because you never can tell with, you know, like open USB ports and stuff.
Yes. So basically, a few years ago, I ran into an analysis of a rogue cable done by a hacker called Mitch. And that kind of dragged me down a rabbit hole of figuring out what was possible with adversarial cables.
Yeah, I've actually seen advertisements for cables that will either blow devices up or will like take over devices and whatever. And I know this is much more possible on Thunder, right, than it is on USB.
It gets complicated because the ports are getting separated from the protocols, right? So when you look at the Thunderbolt 3 port, it's doing its own protocol, it's doing DVI, it's doing USB, it's potentially doing a whole
bunch of... And it basically attaches directly to your PCI bus, which basically leaves your whole computer open.
These things are basically very powerful data bus interfaces, and USB-C is pretty much in the same position. Now, what is usually... The threat is that you have a data connection without knowing that you have a data connection. So now that people use USB for charging, a common attack is an easy attack is the juice jacking attack. So you plug in into a charging port at the airport and somebody has modified that interface so that you're not getting only a power connection, you're also getting a data connection. And USB carries implicit trust for certain types of devices. Human interaction devices, HID devices, are the most common case usually. Keyboards, mice, but there is a whole family of things that are HID devices, like weight scales, barcodes, scanners, magstripe readers. At Princeton a few years ago, they had a class where the students would be taken to a junkyard. They would choose whatever they wanted, and their project for the class was turning that thing into an HID device, because it's relatively easy to add an HID interface to anything. It's like a serial port if you want to think about it. But from the operating system point of view, HID devices are usually trusted. So we have these devices that connect to the computer. And they say, I'm a keyboard. The most famous one is USB rubber ducky, which is a USB stick. But when you connect to it to the machine, it presents itself as a mouse. I'm sorry, it presents itself as a keyboard. And what it does is that it follows its own scripting language to type at superhuman speed. And so you don't have the storage interface because it has presented itself as a keyboard. But it can commandeer the system by spawning a shell, Windows R, typing all sorts of commands at ridiculous speed, and opening a reverse shell to whatever nasty part of the internet you're using to exfiltrate files. So the rubber ducky has become a staple of the pen tester community over the last 10 years. But there are much more aggressive and less trustworthy devices out there as well.
So we're talking about a PC though, right? We're talking about a Windows machine or something like that. Is this also a problem with Macs and with like Linux boxes? I assume it is that you could build such a device for any of those. So
the cables that are meant to do this, and the most recent generation of them, there is one that was originated by Kevin Mitnick, and I think it's called USB Ninja. And another one that's originating by a hacker that goes by the handle MG. And so his cable is known as the OMG cable. And they're cables that look exactly like an Apple or an Apple Lightning cable that you would use to charge an iPhone, or a USB cable that you use to charge your Android devices. And they can be used for attacks against mobile devices.
And these just look like charging cables. These are not like special, like a little USB dongle that you would plug in. This you can actually charge using this cable.
You will not notice anything. And it will have an active data connection and it will be talking to your system. And if it's lucky enough to do it while you're not looking, then the activity would go undetected. And for the rubber ducky, you open the case of the USB key and there is a button in there. And so you can program it and control the behavior as you're preparing the attack through this button. For the OMG cable and the Mitnick cable, the way you do it is with things like a magnet. You put the magnet close to the plug of the cable and that signals to a read switch inside the cable that you're programming it or some other preloading behavior as opposed to production behavior. And things have gotten extremely sophisticated in these last versions. Like the OMG cable actually has geofencing. So you can change its behavior based on where it is. And you could basically say, activate this attack only when Federico is in the office. Otherwise, lie dormant and never use your data connection. So things are getting quite sharp.
That's really interesting. That obviously requires some active components outside of the cable. I would assume some sort of GPS type functionality, just like molded onto the end of the cable or something like that.
There is that kind of functionality and it's inside the cable, I'm sorry to say. So the OMG and USB Ninja are the most recent incarnations of these. But the thing that set me on looking at these devices is a cable that really doesn't have any brand that's made in China and it's been around since 2016. And it comes packaged in blister that you can actually open because it has a phone in it. So the cable itself is a GSM phone. So the blister, you open it, you put a SIM card in there to activate the phone and to know what the phone number is. And then I suppose you give it to the target of your hack. And this is branded as just a data transfer cable. But when it's sold, what it's sold is as a tracking device because this particular one doesn't have GSM. It only figures out its location based on the Wi-Fi access points and other radio beacons that it sees, something like Skyhook Wireless API or the tracking functionality of a phone provider. But there are others with GPS. So they have the ability to do this. Now, this particular one is nasty because we don't really know what it does inside. It's been reverse engineered only so far. So I use an adversarial lab facility to look into it. We don't even have the data sheet for some of the chips in it. I mean, we don't think that the chips were designed for any particular nasty reason, but they're not well documented. And the cable itself has a microphone in it. So it can be used for spying in a wiretapping sense. It can be used for tracking.
That's really interesting that it has all this physical hardware in it and it still looks like a standard cable. Like, how big are the connectors?
So the 2016 one has a pretty big end cable, which is accurate for 2016. It's kind of similar to what Amazon Basics would look like for a USB-A cable. The cables of this year, the USB Ninja and the OMG, are exactly identical to what you would get from Samsung and Apple for charging cables for all the rest.
Wow. So they've really miniaturized this stuff and consumed a lot of the space that's placed into those cables for safety, apparently. I mean, I would assume that there's a lot of plastic around those connectors just to prevent you from getting shocked and stuff. And so they've hollowed all of that out. And
there's also another thing, which is cables these days are not pure cables. They're more like dongles. Instead of having the chips to do protocol translation that you would need to go from, well, to our previous point, Thunderbolt speaking DVI, for example, or I'm sorry, not DVI, DisplayPort is what I meant. Instead of having the chips for that translation, you have chips for nefarious purposes. The part that's more disturbing to me is that I kind of assume that this is always going on between nation states. And actually, it was mentioned by Cory Doctorow as trickle-down surveillance, because supposedly it was part of the NSA exploit catalog. A cable of this kind was part of the internal capabilities that were available. But now these are things at the high end, the ones that are for pen testers maybe are $100. The 2016 Chinese-made cable used to be selling for $10. So it's a little bit absurd, and it's not what I would call progress. Cheaper industrial espionage is not in my progress ledger for the world. I'm not going to say that we don't have bigger problems, but it certainly doesn't look like progress.
At those prices, you could have a pretty wide-ranging attack. You could afford to attack a lot of people at once.
Yeah, you could buy 100 of them. Leave them in random places in airports and hotels and park benches and, I don't know, wherever. Or you could walk to a meeting, you know, and say, oh, I got this really cool new cable. You want to try it? It's so much faster than my other cables at a company that you're trying to do industrial espionage on. Or drop one on the receptionist desk on the way by while you're logging in. And somebody will walk by and go, oh, wow, there's a free cable. I think I'll take that one. You know, I needed one of those cables anyway, right?
I think that it's not very commonplace, fortunately, which is probably why it works, because USB security is broken, but we don't worry about USB security because it's much cheaper for our adversaries and effective for our adversaries to mass attack us over the network, right? So until we resolve network security, the fact that USB security is horrible is only a problem when you look at the news, when they say, well, a USB key was found at Mar-a-Lago and the security official there plugged it into a laptop. I'm like, what? So at the government level, obviously, that shouldn't be happening. At the industrial level, it's more common to have network problems. Once we solve the network problem, this will be the next thing, because this is something that you use to penetrate a military facility. I usually joke that military folks are trained to shoot on sight when they see an abandoned USB drive. I hope they are. but certainly on the corporate setting, it's nothing like that. If I leave a USB key in the parking lot, people will plug it in and try to return it to me, right? They'll go, let's figure out who this belongs to and try to get it back to them. Maybe it's important.
And what's interesting about this, I guess, to me, well, this is why a lot of companies shut off USB ports, which is kind of counterproductive in many ways, because, yeah, you're solving, this is one of those trade-offs and threat surface, attack surface type things. Yeah, you know, you're solving this little rare case, but in the meantime, you've frustrated a million users and you've cost all of them hours a day trying to figure out how to get stuff transferred around. I was just dealing with a company the other day. I had to send them some documents, and they're like, well, you can email them to us. I'm like, well, these kinds of documents, I'm not going to email. Oh, well, we don't really know. You could, I don't know. You could fax them to us. And I'm like, well, that's useful. How about if I send you a USB key? No, my company turns off all the USB ports. Oh, how else can I get them to you? Well, you can't upload them to Dropbox. And if you zip them and put them on some other public medium where they can get to them and put a password on them, they can't download zip files because zip files have been cut off, because those can sometimes contain. And it's like, guys, you're making it where the only way for me to get really private data to you is via email. Like, this is counterproductive. This is really, you know.
Unfortunately, it looks like the only way you can have absolute security for USB is exactly that. You pour glue into the ports, and then people cannot use them, period. You could be a little bit neater and buy locks, but if you buy locks, people will find a way to remove the locks, because the annoyance level is just off the charts. So if you are running, I don't know, a nuclear power plant, and so you have to have absolute security, then the only thing that you can do is pour glue in there or remove them physically. But a little bit less draconian things do exist. Like there are these devices called SyncStop, and that have more vernacular names that I'm not going to use, but SyncStop is usually the recognized trademark. And they are basically dongles where you connect the device that you have on one end and the trusted device on the other end, and it will only allow a power connection. So when I'm charging something in the airport, I use that. My joke is usually that if I bought 100 of those and told people to use them, they still won't use them, but I will feel better about it. that could be a start. Yeah. The other thing is doing basically what Apple is doing, which is bringing back MagSafe. Have your power connection be only a power connection is a good thing. And then you have only the problem of, I need to secure the bus, but at least people are not using the bus for power. Let's eliminate that part of the problem.
I was going to ask, is there anything that a user could do themselves just to see what's going on? I think Wireshark can now dissect USB traffic.
Yes, there is a USB, at least on Windows, I've seen there is a USB driver for Wireshark. So you can sniff the USB network that way. But there are other things. MG that I was mentioning previously, he has made a device that you can put on a cable and it will flash or give you some other kind of notification if there is a data connection. So if you're just plugging in a cable, it's supposed to be inert if there is no device on the other end, right? So if you suddenly see data going through from a cable with nothing on its end, that that kind of gives away that something is going on there. Also, going back to what Russ started asking earlier, yeah, it tends to be a problem across Mac, Windows, and Linux, but there are different kinds of scenarios. So in Windows is the default target, and when you plug an HID device in Windows, and I believe in the Mac just as well, it just gets recognized, it's a keyboard, I'll just make it work. The only way you would notice that something is amiss is that if you go to the hardware page, suddenly you see that your USB key is a keyboard. Wait, what's going on here? But nobody looks there while they're using a key, right? So the other thing is for Linux, there are ways to configure the USB stack so that you can trust only specific device IDs or serial numbers. So that you can basically say, I know that these devices are around my office. I'm going to trust only those devices. I'm not sure how much it helps, but at least you can authorize just a certain set of drives going around and not rogue unknown drives. Also, it doesn't really help if somebody is tailoring an attack against you, which is really what they should be doing if they're using a USB attack right now, because they can find out what your chosen serial number or device ID is and make the key show up with that number. But in the hypothetical blind attack using USB, that would help. And I think it's called USB Guard. It's not difficult at all to configure. And Vivek Gitte has written a good tutorial for it in the last, I think it was just a few weeks ago. I've seen it pass relatively recently.
So you said there are also attacks against phones, right? This isn't just laptops. This is also phones and portable devices, Android and iPhone, iOS, and things like that as well, right?
I focused mostly on computers, but... But the cables are targeting mobile devices just as well. And then there is the other family of attacks, which you kind of hinted at the beginning, which are the USB killer attacks, the ones that have a large capacitor inside. And all that they do is send a 200-volt pulse down to whatever you plug them in so that they're going to fry whatever device you plug them into.
And that's really dangerous in the Thunderbolt. And case, because that's essentially, again, directly tied to your PCIe bus or whatever in the computer. What about routers and switches? Now, if it works against Linux, then it would work against a Linux-based router or a switch, which is, by the way, a vast majority of probably what's deployed today. I mean, you know, because GNOS is FreeBSD, but then there's GNOS Evolve, which is Linux-based. There's Sonic, which is Linux-based. I mean, XR is kind of microkernel-based, but there are, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there now that's very Linux-based. Is there something? I mean, is there anything that attacks like iOS specifically or GNOME specifically that you know of, or Arista EOS or whatever specifically? Or is it really just if you happen to be running a Linux-based
router? I haven't
router?
Been looking. That's a really interesting idea. And I think that it's more probable now as people are moving to newer versions of Linux, right? When embedded Linux was, well, I'm going to date myself, but when embedded Linux was 2.4, there was no problem there because you wouldn't accidentally get a USB stack, even if you didn't want it, right? But now if you're going to embed Linux 4, it's basically a question of, has your embedded engineer decided to remove the USB stack because it wasn't necessary? If you do have it, then most likely you do have it in a form that brings in the ability to just plug devices in and have them recognized. So it could potentially be an issue if people haven't thought about that.
Another attack area I think people probably don't think about very much would actually be public display boards that are just all in one computers. And you don't think about it, but those display boards probably have access to something on your network of value because they have to be able to draw data in order to do the display pieces. So it seems like to me that's something else where it's kind of unknown. Like you just walk by you go into a fast food restaurant and they have those big displays along the back where they're displaying the prices, and you plug one of these things in and bada bing, you have access to it. You can change the price or you can, put up nasty grams or whatever you want to do, or see what kind of network access that thing has and what's pushing stuff to it.
That's a new take on the hack the McFlurry machine.
Yes. You don't want me to become an evil attacker.
I think usually there is the idea that you should have separate networks, right? So at home, because I guess I was born paranoid, I even have a separate Wi-Fi network for guests. So if somebody comes into my home, they get the Starbucks local version, not my home network. And in theory, I never have the time to really finish a proper IoT setup there. And also, I'm starting to wonder if IoT is really a useful thing or just a time sink. But if you do build a real IoT thing at home, in theory, it should be on a separate network, right? Because those devices have poor or non-existent firmware updates. Denial of service attacks against them are going to be something that that you can devise with your two-year-old. So that network is just compromised.
Or they can be used for denial of service attacks, right?
So you should have a lot of separation, and networks are cheap these days, right? So just get the Wi-Fi. Things like McDonald's should have a Wi-Fi system that's in some degree of enterprise grade. They can have 4 or 5 networks, one for the dashboards, one for the McFlurry machine that they're so concerned about, one for the cash registers and probably the manager, and one for the guests. But I agree with you. It's probably not the case, especially with places that built this a while ago. And there is also, at DEF CON, there were a number of discussions in terms of how you provide reverse shells out of the McDonald's Wi-Fi network, because basically it looks like McDonald's Wi-Fi is a common anonymizing choice, according to hackers.
Well, there was an article I saw this week about how some war drivers in Israel went around and they found that they could hack into 70% of the Wi-Fi networks that they discovered. And I thought that was pretty crazy. But anyway, well, we should wrap up. It's getting on close to time for both Tom and I to turn into pumpkins. So Federico, how do people get in touch with you, Federico, if they want to, or, follow your work or whatever the case might be?
Right. So this particular work I presented a couple of times. There is a good recording of it up on the DEF CON YouTube.
Oh, okay.
My website is also easy to find. It's f2.subtol.com. And yeah, there are a few recordings of this. You can see the full treatment of the full range of devices. And I'll leave you with one more thought, which is there is one more type of USB device that we haven't talked about, which is the sort of the dev kit for these attacks and the way you work with this is that you buy some kind of branded thing on eBay, a plasma globe with the name of a brand that people would recognize and they are happy to receive as a gift. And you open it up, you put this in the you wire their power path into this dev kit kind of setup. And now when you get your Hewlett Packard branded plasma globe in the mail, it's actually a USB HID attack. And it's not too strange to get swag from a big company. Lots of us do it. And it's sort of a social attack without the social, because they can just mail it to you. And they don't need to social engineer you. they just rely on the big brand of whoever made the device initially. Put it in the mail. You believe it's plausible that company sent it to you. And off you go. You play with it. If you put it in a power only charger, it's fine. But if you put it, you try it with your laptop, that's another story.
Cool. So Tom, where can people get in touch with you if they want to, or follow your non-existent? I'm not going to finish that sentence.
I'll finish it for you. The non-existent blog. But you can find me on LinkedIn at Tom Ammon and Twitter at the same.
All right, cool. And I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at The Hedge and on rule11.tech and I don't know, wherever else. Thanks, Federico, for joining us for this episode of The Hedge, and we'll catch y'all next time.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.